Hello, my name is Chip Ling. You're listening to Total EM. Today's podcast is going to sound familiar in some ways to things you've probably heard elsewhere. And I'll admit, some of this material is coming from sources such as MCrit or RebelEM. And I do have their links in the show notes because it is such a vital part of this talk, and I want to make sure I gave them the credit for it. But I want to expand on this, and I want to actually make sure that we talk about some things that aren't usually mentioned in those podcasts, or they're so broken up that there's not one spot to go over this. This is some way going to feel like the TXA episode that we just recently had, where we consolidate a lot of this and I threw in some of my own points. So this is kind of that same thing. People really like that. People wanted to hear more of that. And this is something that I've been holding on to a long time and figure out how I want to talk about this. Now, everyone talks about Airway all the time, and I was very reluctant to give that talk, which is why we haven't talked about the Airway in the sense of innovation for a long time. In fact, it's been since podcast 18 with Chris Madej, where we went over the basics. And it really was that. It was just the basics. It was designed for students. And I really wanted to keep it that way because there really wasn't that great of a basics podcast. So we went over that. And then I realized that we need to talk about something that I feel like is something we need to make sure we hit, and that RSI, or rapid sequence innovation, is commonly used, but not for every patient. And what I'm going to talk about today is RTI, the way that I call it this, which is resuscitate, then innovate. Now, this is called all sorts of things. The way I wanted to call it this way is because some of it, like resuscitative sequence innovation or resuscitate before you innovate, none of that stuff really, I just really liked RTI. It made sense as an acronym, and I think it's a way we can talk about this in the future as RTI, resuscitate, then intubate. That's just my own choice, but that's how I'm going to kind of use this in here as the abbreviation. So the first part of this, when we're talking about RTI, is actually discussing the things that are really going to kill our patients, because that's what we're actually trying to do. We're trying to resuscitate them to try and prevent these what are called HOP killers. I really like how this is discussed. HOP stands for hemodynamics, oxygenation, and pH, meaning acidosis. Now, HOP killers are very serious, and this is probably what's going to kill most of our patients. So the first step in RTI is to plan. You need that forethought. You need that careful consideration. You need to think about how you're going to proceed. For example, is this a hypotensive septic shock patient? Then bring that blood pressure right back up. Is this a crashing asthmatic patient that quit moving their air, is no longer having oxygenation? We need to replace that oxygen before we attempt to intubate. Or what about that aspirin overdose who's now responsive? Have you considered how the pH may affect your safety of this intubation? Recognizing those HOP killers is going to be your first part of getting a successful and safe intubation. Now let's talk about for a second hypotension. Now hypotension is going to be a very common cause of death and one that you can very easily prevent. And when you think about this, I want you to carefully consider your approach to this patient. Now, unless this is a trauma patient, IV fluids are going to be your first step. In trauma, you should be giving blood. This is a big pet peeve of mine. Fluids are not actually replacing anything. They make your numbers look pretty temporarily, but blood is what this patient is losing. Blood is what they need more of. The blood is what's carrying the oxygen, those bright red blood cells that you really want. Well, I want more of those pretty red blood cells to actually be in them, not a bunch of saline. The saline isn't carrying any oxygen. It's not doing anything like that. I want that blood to replace what's missing in them. Not only is that going to offer more oxygen for them to carry around, but it's actually going to help replace what we need to do to make this patient better off. Mass transfusion, great, go with that. But whatever the case is, you need to resuscitate this person by bringing back the fluids they're missing. IV fluids, fine outside of trauma, just make sure that you're doing it appropriately. And another big part of why I don't like saline for this is when we are using saline in trauma, all we're doing is diluting out the blood. So again, just make sure that you're picking the appropriate type. Most patients who are hypotensive, there is a safe delay that you can make But just keep in mind that fluids or blood may not be enough for the actual process to occur. And these patients are probably going to need pressure support. If you have profound hypotension, do not wait to say, well, we'll give them 2 liters of fluids and we'll wait then. No, especially if you have a puny IV. You know, this is one of those times when an IO is going to be helpful. If you really can get the cordis in and you get a great big central line in them, or use one of those RIC, the rapid infuser catheters, I don't care what you're using as long as you can get fluids in quickly. But fluids are sometimes not going to be enough. And so you need to plan ahead with a vasopressor. Now, my pressor of choice is going to be norepinephrine, but you may not be able to get that right away. It's going to take a few minutes to get a drip set up. Plan on taking this 5, 10, maybe even longer minutes for this to actually happen. So what you can do quickly is get push dose pressors. And push dose epinephrine is something I've talked about before and something I like to use. I've used it more and more recently because it's safe, it's effective, and people know how to make it. And this is something you can concoct very easily. And I've talked about this before as well. But basically, you take a 10 cc syringe, you drop 9 cc's of saline. If you had those push dose ones, the push saline, you can push a cc of saline out. You've got 9 cc's. Either way, you have 9 cc's of saline. You take the cardiac arrest dose epinephrine, that 1 in 10,000 concentration, you drop a cc of it, you shake it like a cocktail, and now you've got a 1 in 100,000 concoction. So basically, you're going to push 0.5 to 2 mLs of epinephrine at a time. And I make sure to chase that with some saline to push it through the line, because usually you're going to need that. Otherwise, it's just sitting there dead. And so I want to make sure that gets to my patient quickly. And you can repeat that as needed. Usually you do it every few minutes. It's going to last for about 5 or so minutes. But this is something that you can easily adjust while you're waiting for the norepinephrine or whatever you're going to use for this patient to come to the bedside. I would avoid dopamine in almost every instance. Norepinephrine is going to be your much better bet there. Now, with the blood pressure corrected, this is not the end of the hypotension. You need to keep in mind that your medications that you're going to be giving this patient can potentially cause hypotension. And then there's even a period afterwards that you're going to have to worry about hypotension. So keep in mind that the push dose pressor may need to be given several times, especially if you have someone who's trying to chase down a drip and get it set up, because you know you're going to use it for them later anyway. Physiologically, these patients usually respond strongly to sedatives, but paralytics have a harder time reaching the rest of the body and performing what's needed to relax the muscles. So for that reason, I want you to try and use a lower dose of your sedatives and a higher dose of your paralytics. Personally, ketamine is the way to go on this, and there's good evidence to back up the use of ketamine. Now, ketamine is going to be one that's, it's nice because actually it has some pretty good effects catecholamine wise, and it seems like it does a better job with the blood pressure. I've noticed that these are very stable patients when I use the ketamine instead of using things like etomidate, because etomidate, although used frequently, has been associated with hypotension. I know it likes to be used by certain people because they find it more cardiac stable, but it's not always going to be that way. And when it comes to paralytics, I like rocuronium because versus succinylcholine, you have this longer safe apnea period with rocuronium, whereas the succinylcholine has all these contraindications, and especially in a stressful situation when you're trying to keep a track of everything, I just don't like the succinylcholine. If I have to, I give it, but I really try and avoid it whenever I can. I would like to use rocuronium instead. Also gives me more time to do everything else I need to do afterwards without worrying about that patient specifically. So again, my combination is going to be ketamine with rocuronium. That's going to be my preference. The rocuronium is going to have a higher dose than usual, and the ketamine is probably going to have a lower dose than usual. We're talking about probably roughly 1.6 mg per kg on the rocuronium and probably more like half a mg per kg on the ketamine. But you can do regular dosing of ketamine in these patients. It's actually fairly safe. They've done some studies on it. We'll try and include those in the show notes. But you can use ketamine more. So if push comes to shove, you kind of forget about things. You're having a hard time remembering what you need to do. That 1 in 1, that 1 mg per kg of ketamine and rocuronium, if that's all you can remember, that's still going to be a safer bet. But just keep in mind, if you can, try and avoid that. You can even go to the 2 and 2, but again, your ketamine needs to be lower and your rocuronium needs to be higher. And that's true for whatever sedative and paralytic combination you decide. Now, although it can be performed in many cases, awake intubation is probably the hardest thing to do because it requires so much time and resources. You're using topicalized lidocaine and everything like that. There are some great lectures out there on it. Scott Weingart has a great approach. He's even modified it. Some will include both if we can. But the one real benefit with awake intubation is you have the endogenous catecholamine still for that patient, which is important because by keeping them awake and having the endogenous catecholamines, you may not need as much of everything else, but keep in mind that eventually you're going to sedate this patient and everything. So I really think in most cases, really correcting the underlying blood pressure, not relying on the endogenous catecholamines is going to be your better way to go. Now, I think we've taken care of hypotension pretty well, so let's move on to oxygenation. Prior to any intubation, we want to do pre-oxygenation. This is a necessary step. This is one of the things that is a basic part of intubation. You should be doing this every time. You should be pre-oxygenating patients. The patients who are already hypoxemic, though, this is even more vital because not only are we trying to push out the nitrogen, but we have to replace the oxygen that we're currently using. So this denitrogenation process is not just something to help kind of provide a little more stores for when we hit our apneic period, but we want to provide a safer perintubation by making sure that the oxygen we have lost is being put back in as much as possible. So the first step is actually delivering the oxygen. Now, I really like high-flow nasal cannula. Now, to some people, high-flow nasal cannula is going to be 6 liters a minute. That's not what we're talking about. We're not even talking about 15 liters a minute, although this is what's commonly used, and this is fine, but if at all possible, it doesn't matter whether you're on the ambulance or in the emergency department, wherever you're at, geographically shouldn't matter if at all possible, because even those big oxygen tanks on the ambulances, they should have enough in them, or at least you should be running enough in there so that you can crank that sucker up all the way, make it flush. Basically, that thing sounds like a rocket going off. If you can get that oxygen cranked all the way up on nasal cannula, you could be looking at possibly 60 liters a minute or even more than that going through the nasal cannula, which sounds like a lot and it can be uncomfortable to patients, but I would highly recommend that you try and do this as much as possible. Most patients will tolerate even the 15 liters a minute, but if you can, crank that sucker up as high as you can go. When it comes to this, also making sure that you're also doing other things like a non-rebreather mask. If this patient is someone with shunt physiology or someone who you're going to be bagging, have a very low threshold of using a PEEP valve. If they are having shunt physiology, you need to be using a PEEP valve anyway, usually set between somewhere up to 5 and 15 centimeters of water. The reason why is because you want to make sure you're kind of basically doing CPAP recruitment. If the patient won't tolerate this, or if it's just simply not enough, if they actually need to be on BiPAP or CPAP, then you're looking at something that's called DSI. And DSI is getting used more and more. DSI stands for delayed sequence intubation. Basically, what you're doing is you're giving an uncooperative or combative patient or someone who just simply needs better oxygenation ketamine. And what you're doing is you're providing that dissociative dose of ketamine. Again, you know, in your hypotensive patient, this is probably going to be around 0.5 mgs per kg. Again, you can go higher to 1 or even 2 mgs per kg, depends on your situation. But basically, you want to dissociate them. Now, remember, ketamine with dissociation means that they will still be spontaneously breathing, which is what exactly what you want, because what you're doing is you're allowing them to breathe. Now, you can still set your settings more than that, so you can force in the air if you need to, but what you're trying to do is you're trying to get them to oxygenate by using that machine. By them being dissociated, they're basically not going to fight you. Now, ketamine has another benefit that I didn't mention before. Not only does it help keep the blood pressure up and stuff like that, but it provides bronchodilation, kind of similar to propofol, except for without the side effects of propofol we were worried about, like the hypotension. So when I have patients who need that bronchodilation, this is a great option to go with. Helps bring up the oxygen saturation. And once you get that better, now you can move on to your apneic oxygenation. Now, apneic oxygenation, basically, now you're going to take off your mask, whatever you're using, the non-rebreather, the bag valve mask, or the DSI approach, we're using a CPAP or BiPAP to oxygenate this patient. You take all that off, you leave the nasal cannula on. This is why every patient, when you're intubating them, should have a nasal cannula. They're still going to get that oxygen. Again, you've got that cranked all the way up, so you got plenty of oxygen running through their nose, and it's passively diffusing into the lungs, which is exactly what we want. So this provides a longer, safe apneic period. Now, one more thing to tie in on the oxygenation side is that it's very important to optimize the patient position. Now, I've talked about position before, again, in the basics podcast, but basically what I'm talking about here is to bring up their head and bring them in a more anatomical position. When they're laying flat on their back, this is not a good position for them. This is something that you can easily try at home, walk up against a wall or wherever you're at right now, as long as you're not in the car, but walk up against some wall and lay completely flat against it. Put your head all the way back and everything. Some of us can breathe pretty well laying totally flat, but usually not. Usually you're going to need to move your head forward a little bit, and that's the same kind of motion that we need to do when we elevate the head of the bed. So ramping your patient is not a bad idea. You get everything in better alignment. This is a good technique in general, but this is especially good in oxygenation because it makes it easier for them to receive the oxygen that you're trying to do. And all of this combined is going to provide a safer and more effective intubation. So don't keep that just for your hot killers like the oxygenation. Use the head of bed elevation for pretty much everyone. So acidosis is the last hot killer. That's the pH one. And patients in acidosis are probably the most difficult to intubate and probably the most dangerous of all of them to intubate because this is the one you want to avoid if at all possible. They're a ticking time bomb and they're easy to miss. You may be distracted by the fact that they're altered and not think about what's causing them to be altered. Think about the drug overdoses, for example, like aspirin, ethylene glycol, ethanol, methanol, or even the diabetic ketoacidosis. You know, you don't really pay attention to what's causing their altered mental status at first. You just realize that they don't have a safe airway, they're tachypneic, and you decide that, nope, this is someone who's not safe, I'm going to go ahead and intubate them. And if you don't plan for this, if you're not looking for this, you can actually cause them to have increased acidosis because they're going to retain the CO2 that they're actively trying to blow off, which leads to cardiac dysrhythmias, which leads to death. And we want to avoid that if at all possible by delaying that time to intubate, to try and avoid intubation entirely. But if we can't avoid the intubation entirely, then we need to make that period where they're going to be apneic as brief as possible. Because even though we're doing apneic oxygenation, even though if we're providing oxygen the entire time, when a patient is not breathing, they're not able to blow off their CO2 and their CO2 will continue to rise. So keep that in mind when you're dealing with these patients. You need to make sure you have someone not only who's extremely competent in how to intubate, so this is not the time for a novice, but you need to make sure you have someone who's very competent in altering the ventilator for when you do intubate this patient. Sodium bicarbonate, frequently used, probably not a good idea. This is controversial at best. There's a lot of stuff theoretically that makes sense for why you'd use sodium bicarb, but remember, what does sodium bicarb eventually convert into? Well, it converts into CO2. And so what happens is you already have a patient who's maxing out their attempts to blow off their CO2, and you just added more of it. Well, you could actually lead to dysrhythmias. Now, I know people are going to say, well, this may help, and I may even draw their serum pH, and it may look better. True, their serum pH may look better, but based on studies that we have, the intracellular pH, which we actually care about, doesn't improve, nor does the catecholamine response or the hemodynamics, for that matter. So with the current literature lacking solid support for this, I really think that this dogma needs to go by the wayside, at least until we can find something better. Now, our other options are pretty limited because basically all we have left is what's called VapOx or ventilator-assisted pre-oxygenation. This is really cool. Scott Weingart, and I've now mentioned him twice, but he's got great stuff out there. And then Rebel EM has a great synopsis on this as well, but I'd encourage you to review those in more detail and all the specifics of it. Even his intubation checklist, Scott Weingart's, includes the details for it, at least the original intubation checklist, which is the one I still teach off of because it has a lot more detail. Again, we'll include those in the show notes too because I like using that whenever possible. His abbreviated one, his 2.0 version, is still good, but it lacks a lot of the finer points that are good to have in an immediate situation. So essentially what this is, though, VapBox, is that you're providing hyperventilation so that they can blow off CO2 as quickly as possible. And he goes through their three stages and how you do it. But what you're trying to do is you want to make sure you measure their end-tidal CO2 both before and after the intubation. And you want to try and continue respirations for as long as possible, all the way up to when you finally are going to stick the laryngoscope in the mouth to put the tube in. And again, this needs to be someone who knows what they are doing. This is not the time for a teaching moment. This needs to be the best, most competent person in the room who's got the best setup. And we'll talk about that here more in a second. But essentially, if you can do this correctly and increase that respiratory rate quickly after you intubate, you're going to be able to provide further hyperventilation, which is going to allow for the CO2 to blow off, which is going to help you correct their acidosis. All right, and that's it for the hop killer side. Now I want to talk to you about some other things that are on my mind that I feel like are all part of the RTI approach. Because unlike RSI, there are going to be some of these same points, but even more important. So when it comes to monitoring, once you've addressed the hop killers, it's time to think about the rest of your resuscitation. And this patient needs very close monitoring. Now, usually we have staff in the room and they're pretty good at what they're doing, but we need to make sure that someone specifically gets designated to watch the monitor. They don't get to watch you intubate. They don't get to watch other stuff going on in the room, such as the person who's attempting a second IV or is putting a Foley in at the same time for whatever reason, whatever the case may be. Do not let this person get distracted. They need to focus on the monitor and that's it. Now, remember that oxygen saturations in the critically ill patient are going to be delayed. This is not going to be an instantaneous number like you would get in the well healthy person, where it's only a couple of seconds or maybe even truly spontaneous. But what's going to happen with them is that this can be delayed up to a minute, really, but you won't know exactly how long because, again, that patient's not going to show it until time moves on. So what I want you to keep in mind is that what the monitor is showing, especially when it comes to RTI, is that it's usually, no matter what the cause is, acidosis, oxygenation, or hemodynamic issues, this patient is going to be someone who is probably going to have a delayed oxygen saturation. So when the initial temp fails, for whatever reason, you need to pull out as quickly as possible and not rely on the monitor getting low. If the monitor is already getting low, you're already behind, and you've probably waited too long to pull out. So you also need to circulate the blood pressure frequently, like every 1 or 2 minutes kind of thing. This needs to be very, very closely monitored. And you need to make sure that the waveforms are good on the oxygen saturation, as well as that you have a good, accurate heart rate. Check the pulse, see if it matches the numbers on the screen. If they don't, you need to make sure this is done correctly. So again, this is part of the resuscitative measures before you actually intubate the patient. If this is someone who's really unstable and you have the opportunity for it, I'd really encourage you to at least think about using an arterial line placement for your blood pressures rather than circulating the blood pressure, because let's face it, in most of these patients who are going to be critically ill with markers that are all off, that blood pressure is probably not going to be entirely accurate. And as we know through previous stuff, the pulses are going to be off, so don't rely on a radial pulse as being a good enough blood pressure. This is probably all crap, and you need to actually focus on something else. So if you can do an arterial line, that's great. And if not, then make sure that you're actually watching this closely. And keep in mind that it's going to take a little bit of time for that blood pressure to circulate. So I'd say if you do it Q1 or Q2 minutes, and it takes a minute or two to measure, you're really getting Q5 vital signs. And so we probably need to be getting it more frequently than that in our complex patients. So again, that's why I like the idea of an ART line placement, if at all possible. Speaking of equipment, the patient this sick needs the absolute best attempt. Again, this is going to be whatever supplies you feel most comfortable with and you have on hand. For me personally, and I know there's going to be debate about this, and honestly, I don't care because this is what I feel good with. The video laryngoscope is going to be my way to go. And I have a lot of reasons why I do that. I can talk about that more if someone really wants to hear me rant about it, but you've all probably listened to someone before talk about why the video laryngoscope's better. And I've actually got some stuff already on the blog, and I'll put that on there because it's a great podcast to listen to as well with Jeff Jarvis. But long story short, video laryngoscope for me, I will have a DL backup in case stuff hits the fan. I'm going to need that. But realistically, I'm going to stick with my video laryngoscope. And knock on wood, the last few years, I've been pretty successful at that. And only because of a weird screwy situation did I actually have to go to DL. And that was simply because of an equipment issue. But I was ready to go. There was no issues with it. So you still had to be competent at both. But for me, I'm going to go with the video first because I feel much more competent with it. And I feel much more confident, which is very important when you come to these high-risk situations. Now, you need to make sure that you have what's best for you and never forget the suction, especially if you use video. Although, again, if you plan well and use the salad technique, again, another thing I'll include in the show notes, you'll see that this is very easy to manage. But also make sure that you pick a large ET tube. This is going to help with your ventilation. It drives me nuts when people pick too small of tubes. And I believe that in almost every patient who's an adult, you could probably stick an 8-0 easy. And realistically, if I can, I may even go bigger, but 8 is my minimum. I don't like 7s. I don't like 7.5s. And trust me, the people upstairs are going to like you if this patient's going to need a bronch because they're going to want an 8 or bigger. So save yourself the time. Put in as big a tube as possible, at least a size 8. Now, again, we're talking about resuscitation, right? When with the RTI technique, all the more that you need to have a Crite kit ready and a bougie. The bougie is going to be there because this is a great tool when it comes to a difficult airway. We don't actually have Crite kits at my main shop, and so instead, it's a scalpel, finger, a bougie, and a size 6 tube, which is about the only time I'm going to have a size 6 tube out in an adult is because I'm preparing for a Crike. And so I want to make sure we have all that stuff ready. That bougie and having that scalpel is usually going to be a big deal because they're not the ones that are directly laying out. So make sure you have that ready. Your 6 tube can be easily accessed. That's the other point. And just be ready for that. Consider your Crikon scale. That's another thing I really like, the Crikon, because think about how this goes. And these are people that if you have the time and measures, go ahead and mark the skin. Go ahead and prepare for that Kaiko, that can't intubate, can't oxygenate event. As mentioned, the airway vortex, because this is probably not a patient where if you're dealing with RTI, that you're going to want to actually try 3 attempts. That patient's most likely not going to be stable enough to have 3 attempts done, and you need to make sure that you're ready to go quickly because you may get 1, maybe 2 attempts at this before they're too sick for you to try a 3rd attempt from above, and a supraglottic airway is most likely not going to suffice for whatever reason. Also, a quick point, make sure that you have end-tidal CO2 available. I prefer using the waveform or the quantitative end-tidal CO2 versus the color change, but a lot of times, especially at our shop, the color change gets set up first, and then we switch over to the quantitative. That's fine as long as you have another way to confirm. For me, that is going to be the ultrasound machine. You may ask, well, what about lung sounds and what about chest x-rays? Great, use that for your documentation purposes and blah, blah, blah. But realistically, the ultrasound is the first thing I'm going to pick up. And great if that person tells me they got lung sounds, but lung sounds aren't reliable. The chest x-ray takes time. I want to know immediately if I'm in the right place. And so what I'm going to do with the ultrasound is I'm going to put it to the trachea first. I'm looking for my artifact. If I've gotten the right spot, I'm then going to look at the lungs and I'm going to check for lung sliding on both sides to make sure I didn't do a main stem. And usually I can do that in a few seconds time. And I can tell just as quickly as the person who's listening for lung sounds and much more reliably. So this is something that's very important to me. This is something that even pre-hospitally with the right ultrasound machine, you can very easily do this. And by right ultrasound machine, I mean basically any ultrasound machine you can do this with that's worth its weight. All right. Now, another thing to talk about is personnel. When it comes to personnel, you need to keep in mind that you also need to pick the right personnel, just like you pick the right equipment. So you need to make sure you have at least one assistant at the head of the bed for the person who's intubating. Most likely, if you're listening to this, this is probably because you are the person who's going to be intubating. And if not, good for you. If you're going to be one of the people who helps me out, I absolutely need you to listen to this so you know how to do this. And I'd encourage anyone who's going to be involved in intubation to listen to this podcast because of what it can offer for you and your team. So the reason why I say more than one assistant or at least one assistant is because they're going to be doing different things. You probably have one person who's going to be bagging. You're also going to have someone who's going to be having your tube ready and your suction ready and stuff like that. To allow this to happen as quickly as possible, you need to move around. Your person who's bagging is usually also going to be the same person who's going to be operating your ventilator, at least if you have RT around. So usually for us, there's going to be an RT. There'll be either a second provider or a nurse who's going to be at the head of the bed as well to help with the intubation. And then you have, you know, another nurse or a tech who can look at the monitor, plus someone who's pushing drugs. So this is quite a few people, but you need to make sure you have at least one of them at the head of the bed with you. Now, if you're in a pre-hospital environment, that second person may be doing a lot of different jobs. But keep in mind, you can even have a firefighter, if you're in a pre-hospital setting, watch the monitor. Most of them will know the basics of what they need to look for. You can at least tell them really quickly what they need to watch for. And so that your partner can bag the patient. You can have the tube in a good spot for you. But whatever the case is, you want to make sure that you plan this as much as possible. So pre-planning is a huge part of this. Sometimes you as the intubator may decide that you want to take a quick look. This is acceptable in the right circumstances. Say this is going to be someone who you think is going to be a very difficult airway, but I would use this briefly and very sparingly. Do not do this out of habit because you're actually setting yourself up for your own failure. Because once you start looking, you're like, well, I need to see this or that. And then you start spending more time in the mouth than you need to. Whereas if this is a, hey, I just want to take a quick look and see what my mal and potty is. Even your mal and potty is not that helpful in most cases, except for seeing how easy it is to oxygenate a patient. But usually you're already past that point when you're getting to this. So to me, this is going to be one of those times when I'm going to try and avoid that first look if possible, because my plan is intubate. And this is another reason why I really like the video laryngoscope. I can usually do this without any issues, but that's beside the point. So what I do want to say though, is that you need to clearly define your roles. Who's doing what? What's the plan? And this is hard to do. Now, we've talked about this recently as a resuscitationist, that you need to plan as much as possible ahead of time. You need to think this through your head. You need to run through scenarios, all that. And you need to talk about this with staff. Now, we've gotten to such the point at my shop after being there for a little while that the nurses, the RTs, they all know what I like, not because of just the experiences in the room when it's going on, but also because we've had these nice conversations outside of these events. And so I'd really encourage you to do the same. This is how you get people to all work at the same time on the same page. Okay, so we've gotten to the point of post-intubation. We got the tube in, and hopefully you aren't having to try and figure out how to put a tube in because you've done this before, because you're used to sick patients. Because if you don't know how to intubate and you're listening to this, and this is your first time to actually intubate someone, this is not the right time for that. If at all possible, someone else who's, again, much more competent should be doing these difficult intubations. Because RTI is not that time when you want to use it for learning. This is one of the times you need to do someone who's very competent at the skill. Now, confirmation, again, is key. We've already talked about that, a lot of detail, but when it comes to post-intubation, besides the confirmation, do not forget analgesia. This drives me absolutely nuts. This is a great way to piss me off. Every time I mention intubation, I make sure to talk about post-intubation sedation, analgesia. Analgesia is extremely important. Now, most likely these patients are not going to need as much medicine because they're already acutely ill, but do not use the excuse of endogenous catecholamines crap or whatever else as the reason why you're not giving the patient appropriate analgesia. If you're that worried about blood pressure, then you, by God, should be doing something to take care of it, such as pressors, because you need to make these patients comfortable. It is no good if they rip out their tube after you've intubated them. You have not fixed anything. You have probably made your situation a lot worse and a hell of a lot harder for whoever's coming in after you. So do not do this. Analgesia the hell out of them. Make them feel better. Make them feel like the tube's no longer trying to kill them. And then you can worry about your other stuff. And again, this is very easy to do. Use pressors, properly fluid resuscitate. Do whatever you need to do to get that blood pressure safely up. The analgesics are key. Now, I'll admit the paralytics, especially the rocuronium, this can be helpful, at least at first, so you can bring the blood pressure up without having to worry about the drop-off. But again, this is not the time to use paralytics as your only means of keeping that patient sedated. Never really should it be that. You really need to try and use your analgesia as much as possible or proper sedatives and pick those wisely. Again, ketamine is a great option because ketamine will provide sedation and analgesia, but if you need to, you can use things like fentanyl. But whatever the case may be, you need to make sure you're choosing it wisely, and if you need to, you have pressure support or whatever else to go with it. But yeah, that's the main thing I have to say with that, and it drives me nuts when I don't see that used properly. So keep that in mind when you actually intubate people. All right, now the final part of all this, part of RTI is to also debrief afterwards. And this is extremely important because, like I said, the people at my shop know what I like because we talk about it afterwards. And I had, for example, a couple of RTs, absolutely love working with them. They're my favorites right now to do stuff with because they're quick to learn. They enjoy our conversations. And it was kind of funny, the one day I didn't even realize it, they had all my stuff already out. They knew exactly what blades I wanted as my backups. They knew what tubes, they knew how I wanted my stuff set up, everything like that, ready to go. And I didn't have to tell them anything. But that's because of the conversations that we have after debriefs, because the first time they asked me, why did you want a tube this size? And I explained to them, and they're like, that makes a whole lot of sense. And so they knew from then on why I wanted it versus just saying, this is what I want. Have these discussions with your team. Your staff will appreciate it, and everyone becomes a better resuscitationist. Again, this does not just have to be the person who's intubating. Everyone on the team should be having this conversation. And especially true, everyone needs to congratulate one another afterwards. Constructive criticism is always an important part when it's appropriate. Make sure that you are bringing people up, though, because really, if you did have this difficult of a patient and you successfully intubated them, that's something worthy of congratulation by itself. It may not have been as pretty as you wanted, but if they did it safely and no one died and they are actually able to make a good recovery as a result, you did all the right stuff. Again, these are not the easiest patients to intubate. So if you can do this safely and quickly and effectively, you've done your job. Yes, there's always room for improvement. Always, always, always. Even the people who've done it a lot of times, there are plenty of places to actually get better at it. Could you have been in the mouth for a shorter amount of time? Could you have more easily guided your tube into the proper position? All those types of things are things you can bring up. And talking about the team cohesion, stuff like that. But basically, make sure to congratulate everyone. They've already done a great job. And this is something that I didn't get to talk about last time, but I want to make sure to mention it now, is that when it comes to resuscitation, you really do need to work as a team. All right, this was a longer podcast. I'm very thankful that you have listened to it. Please give me your feedback on RTI. Let me know what you think. Otherwise, until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere. Thank you for downloading another episode of Total EM. We want to thank our bandwidth sponsor, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this show. You can also see them on our website, but we also have included links to their website, funnyrx.com. Again, thank you, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this episode.